Monster Man, episode 452, Serene the Skeleton. Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. In today's episode, we're going to be taking a look at some monsters from Monsters Manual, the 1993 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 2nd Edition. But before we do that, it's time for a few quick announcements. First and most importantly, I'd like to welcome a new Patreon backer. Yes, this is someone who's gone to patreon.com/monsterman and pledged as little as $1 a month to help support the show. And if, like today's backer, you pledge at the $2 or higher level, you'll also be getting all new episodes of my other podcast, Patron Deities, in which I take a look at the myths and religions of the world and the inspiration we can find in them for our fantasy RPGs. There are over 120 back episodes for new subscribers to enjoy, and we are about to start a new season all about Tengrism, the religion of medieval Central Asia that's making a comeback today. So thank you very much to new patron Drew Bergstrom. Your support means a lot to me. Also, a scheduling note. You may notice that this is not a special episode. Typically, there is a special episode on a Friday. My recording schedule got a little disrupted, so this week we're having two regular episodes, and then next week we're going to have two special episodes, one on the Penanggalan, a monster from Malaysian and other Southeast Asian ghost stories, and one on boars. Boars are a recurring theme in my work in particular, and I thought I'd do a little self-examination and try to figure out why. Plus, of course, an all-new episode of Patron Deities. So, a little bit of a disruption in the normal schedule, but the same episodes are coming out, just in a slightly different order. All right, let's get started taking a look at these monstrous manual creatures. We start off with the Serene, which originally appeared in Monster Manual 2. And the Serene, as it appears in Monster Manual 2, is basically just a kind of mermaid adapted to higher level parties. You know, they can charm people with their song. They have a bunch of other magic powers. They can reduce people's intelligence by touching them. For some reason, they frequently have javelins of lightning. The Serene in Monstrous Manual, to my mind, is an unusual but encouraging example of a monster that gets some additional context from its like ecology section in a way that is actually very helpful, which is not usually the case. Usually what we get is a monster that is complete in its original appearance and then gets a bunch of filling in of the details of that completeness, but not in a way that adds anything new. But I think that the secret here is that the Serene in Monster Manual 2 is kind of incomplete. I wonder if it's a scenario monster, because it's not motivated to do anything, and it's not clear why it would either be for you or against you, right? It's just a bunch of powers. It's clear that what's interesting to the writers in Monster Manual 2 is how powerful the Serene is, quite a challenging opponent. But it's not clear why you would be fighting it, which is a problem that D&D has with a lot of its aquatic creatures, frankly, but never mind. Because here, we actually get some more interesting stuff to do with the Serene. So we're told that they, quote, live to sing and to think about the sea, close quotes, which is a purpose, kind of. But it implies this kind of solitary existence, and it does say that they live typically alone, but sometimes in small groups, in quite like remote, out-of-the-way places. They'll die if they stray too far from the sea, or if they are prevented from singing for a long time. And as immortals, they know a lot about the local area, and they may be interested in exchanging this knowledge for companionship. Now, I know that when we say companionship, it's a mermaid. They like to entice human and demi-human males to stay with them. So we're meant to think that companionship means, you know, hugging and a kissing. But I actually quite like the idea that the Serene's life is quite lonely. They live by themselves in sort of secluded coves and whatnot. And yeah, that must be a pretty challenging existence. And so even for solitary creatures, they must get lonely. So I like the idea that, you know, there they are on their lonely isle, trading knowledge about shipwrecks for people to come and just like tell them about the outside world and, you know, tell them stories about Antra's vast and Desart's idol like Othello does in Othello. Maybe not with the same sad conclusion. And so in order to get information about the wreck of the Blue Jewel, you sort of agree to like come back every year and like sing them all the new songs you've learned, like good chance for bards to shine a little bit. And so if you have this kind of ongoing relationship, then like later on when you're high enough level to be able to deal with something that might threaten a Serene, that's when you come back and you find that, you know, some evil villain has kidnapped the Serene and is, you know, keeping her on dry land and preventing her from singing until she tells him about the wreck of the Blue Jewel or whatever, right? And then you have to go and put a stop to their evil schemes. So pop the champagne and put on the party hats. I found a monster in Monster's Manual that I think is genuinely substantially improved from its appearance in a previous book. No surprises, it was Monster Manual 2. But, like, yeah, I could work with this. So yeah, I could work with this. See, this is what that like ecological and social contextualizing looks like when it's working. And it works primarily when the context has like still a little mystery about it, and also when the context was insufficient the first time around. In fairness, a lot of early monster entries are pretty bare bones. It's just that a lot of the time Monster's Manual fills in those entries with kind of what everybody thought already. So it's not contributing anything that's really new. But this is a little bit more interesting. Even if that stuff about not being able to sing and, you know, staying away from the water is pretty standard mermaid fare. All right, next up we have kind of the opposite, but not in a bad way, which is the skeleton. The skeleton is an absolutely stock, morally neutral horde monster. You know, it is the definition of a good worker, right? The skeletons turn up, they put in their hours. They're not fancy. Like, nobody's favorite monster is the skeleton necessarily. But fighting skeletons, that's never a bad time. As is the case for many of the monsters in this book, we get a little bit more discussion about, like, how they are created and how they are animated. I don't recall there being that much of this in Monster Manual, although there was some for some of these monsters. I think this is symptomatic of D&D becoming more like a totalizing rule set rather than a collection of individual monsters. That is to say, we're starting to think about, like, given that, you know, evil high priests can raise skeletons, what about PCs who want to raise skeletons? And it says that good clerics will only raise a skeleton if they have received consent. So if the person who has died wanted to be raised as a skeleton. That's kind of an interesting idea. You know, skeletons are not like ghosts. They're not the spirit of the person trapped in the material plane. They're just an animated creature made from human remains, but they are not that person. So, or at least that's how it seems to me. They're just kind of mindless constructs. Arguably, skeletons are constructs rather than undead, but monsters are grouped thematically rather than taxonomically. What that means is that you could definitely have, for example, imagine like a temple of a particular deity where the guards of that temple were the devotees of that deity who had kind of like willed their bodies to the temple's defense to be turned into skeletons. A bit like, you know, leaving your organs to science or, you know, ticking the transplant box on your driver's license. I like that idea because normally when you see someone commanding a legion of the undead, that's pretty creepy. But here it's like, ah, no, our ancestors fight in our defense. You know, it's our great honor to be brought back as skeletons in order to protect our descendants, to protect our village, to protect our shrine. But also, in such an army, you could not have any of the kind of like higher ranking undead, typically. Although we have seen that there are rules for good mummies, but like you wouldn't have death knights or vampires. You would get skeleton warriors, actually, which we'll talk about in a second. But the idea of like a legion of the undead being commanded by living officers is a really interesting one. It's like a force multiplier. You know, we only have a small number of people in our village, but because the number of dead is always increasing, we actually have this big, like, skeleton thing. I was reading something about long barrows in the Neolithic period. I think they're Neolithic. They might be Mesolithic. I don't know. And the way in which archaeologists believe, or many archaeologists believe, that they represent a kind of expression of sort of communal solidarity. Like, all the members of the community are buried together there. So it's like, this is a resting place of not, like, specific individuals, but the ancestors. You know, we have the power that our ancestors will actually rise to defend us. And that's actually kind of a fun idea. Other than that, you know, these are skeletons. They're fine. And we get three types, because we also get the monster skeleton and the animal skeleton. Again, conveniently combining monsters that were published in different places into a single entry. Nothing to write home about in the skeleton section, although actually I do quite like that good skeleton concept, but nothing to complain about either. Next up, we have the Skeleton Comet Giant. Now check this out. This is a new monster. They are a Ravenloft creature, and they are not the skeletons of giants. They are the skeletons of humans, but enlarged. There's a couple of good things about them here. First, I like the image. They have this like fire burning in their rib cage, kind of in like the void in their torsos. So I like the idea that they're like coming towards you in the dark, because it's always nighttime in Ravenloft, right? And you see these like flickering flames coming along at about head height. You know, what's that all about? But then you realize that they're burning in the chest cavities of these horrible skeletons. That's pretty cool. It's also a way to kind of like bridge the gap. So Ravenloft has this thing where it is a gothic horror setting, but it's a fantasy adventure game, if that makes sense. And that leaves you with some gaps in your monsters, because typically gothic horror monsters, not always, but typically, are kind of at a human scale. So if you want some big giant bullies with long reaches and they can like swing their big scythes and whatnot, you kind of got like the Colossus of Elorn and that's it. Your big horror monsters, your kaijus and your Loch Ness monsters and so forth, not really. I mean, you get a Loch Ness monster in Ravenloft, that'd be fine. But in general, it is a human scale monster world. And so this monster kind of bridges the gap a little bit, because it's not like there aren't giants in Ravenloft, I don't think, to have the skeletons of. But, like, here's some, you know, mad wizard or priestess making giant skeletons kind of artificially. So this is, like, a good utility monster. Again, you know, when you want, like, that bony skeleton war aesthetic, but you want a monster that's a little more challenging for your higher-level Ravenloft characters. Finally, we have the skeleton, comma, warrior, which is weird. They are warriors, comma, skeleton, not skeletons, comma, warrior. They're not warrior skeletons. They're skeleton warriors. Anyway, none of it matters. These are the skeleton warriors, as previously discussed. They appeared in, I want to say, the Fiend Folio. I don't have it in front of me. I've told the story about how every time I watched the D&D cartoon when I was a kid, it was the episode about the Skeleton Warrior, which was pretty cool. In my mind, the images are much more evocative and kind of Chris Achilleos looking than they probably really were. Maybe I just think that because he had a giant bird. Anyway, they're fine. This is pretty much the same as they are in their original appearance, and they were okay then, and they're okay now. Like in the cartoon, the challenge of the Skeleton Warrior is that it is essentially the protagonist of a different story, and if you're just gonna fight it, then all that stuff is not really super relevant, so it feels like a bit of wasted effort. I guess there's going to be a lot of like shenanigans around bad guys trying to get their hands on the Skeleton Warrior circlet, and you realize like you can't fight the Skeleton Warrior because he's very powerful, but if you could just get the circlet, then the problem would be solved. I guess that's the gist. It's fine. It's a good monster. I'm quite fond of it for personal reasons, but also it's a fun time, and it's nice to have some skeletons that are a little bit different from the other skeletons. Alright, that is about all the monsters that we have time for today. In our next episode, we've got the first of a pair of special episodes, and we're going to be taking a look at the Penanggalan, a creature from Malaysian folklore, Malaysian ghost stories, and the broader issue of monsters in positions of trust in society. So I hope that you will join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening.
If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.